The man made no effort to repair their tents, for by now it was dark and nobody really cared anyhow. They simply spread the tent cloths as best they could and weighted them down with rocks. Then they spread out their sleeping bags, which had been soaked anew during the trip in the boats, then lay down and fell asleep. Throughout the night the wind continued to shriek down from the mountains. It got hold of the docker, the heaviest of the boats, and swung her completely around. During his watch, McElroy looked on helplessly as the wind picked up a large bag of ragged old blankets and carried it out to sea. The men who were sleeping on the ground were slowly covered by an accumulation of snow, and by 4 o'clock everyone was sleeping on the ground because the tents had threatened to blow away and had to be taken down. The blizzard persisted throughout that day and into the next. Hardly a man stirred from the meagre protection of his sleeping bag until 11 a.m. when Shackleton ordered all hands out to kill penguins. Ord Lees wrote, "The blizzard was, if anything, worse. It was impossible to face the wind. The driving snow rushed down one's throat as one breathed and choked one." There were about 200 penguins altogether, and of that number they managed to secure a total of 77. "Skinning them with our already partially frostbitten hands was painful work," Ord Lees continued, "for to bare the hand for very few minutes in such a blizzard means almost certain frostbite. We sought shelter as we could find, but it was only the warmth of the dead penguins that saved our hands." The weather cleared briefly during the night, and the hulking cliffs of the island stood out in silhouette against the star-filled sky. By morning, a fresh blizzard had begun, but it was not quite so bad as the last one. It was April the 20th, a day notable for only one reason. Shackleton finally made official what everyone had expected for a long time. He would take a party of 5 men and set sail in the Caird for South Georgia to bring relief. They would leave as soon as the Caird could be made ready and provisioned for the trip. The news came as no surprise to anyone. In fact, a formal announcement was unnecessary. The subject had been discussed openly even long before the party had left Patience Camp. They knew that whatever island they might ultimately reach, a boat journey of some sort would be necessary to bring rescue to the party as a whole. Even the destination, illogical as it might look on a map, had been settled to everyone's satisfaction. There were 3 possible objectives. The nearest of these was Cape Horn, the island of Tierra del Fuego, Land of Fire, which lay about 500 miles to the northwest. Next was the settlement of Port Stanley in the Falkland Islands, some 550 miles, very nearly due north. Finally, there was South Georgia, slightly more than 800 miles to the northeast. Though the distance to South Georgia was more than half again as far as the journey to Cape Horn, weather conditions made South Georgia the most sensible choice. An easterly current, said to travel 60 miles a day, prevails in the Drake Passage, and almost incessant gales blow in the same direction. To reach either Cape Horn or the Falkland Islands would mean beating to windward against both of these colossal forces. It was enough to dare a 22-foot boat on these storm-wracked waters without trying to drive her to windward. En route to South Georgia, on the other hand, the prevailing winds would be generally astern, at least in theory. All this had been discussed and discussed again, and though the Caird's chances of actually reaching South Georgia were remote, a great many men genuinely wanted to be taken along. The prospect of staying behind, of waiting and not knowing, of possibly wintering on this hateful island, was far from attractive. Shackleton had already made up his mind, after long discussions with Wilde, not only as to who should be taken, but who should not be left behind. Worsley would be indispensable. They would travel perhaps 1,000 miles across the stormiest ocean on the globe. The ultimate goal was an island no more than 25 miles wide at its widest point. To guide an open boat that distance under conditions that were frightening even to contemplate, and then to strike a pinpoint on the chart, was a task that would sorely tax even Worsley's skill as a navigator. After him, Shackleton chose Crean, McNeish, Vincent, and McCarthy. Crean was tough, a seasoned sailor who did as he was told, and Shackleton was not sure that Crean's rough, tactless nature would lend itself well to a period of enforced and perhaps long waiting. McNeish was now 57 years old and really not up to the journey. But both Shackleton and Wilde felt that he was still a potential troublemaker and not a good man to be left behind. Furthermore, if the Caird were damaged by ice, a possibility which was far from remote, McNeish would prove invaluable. Jack Vincent bore the same stigma as McNeish. His compatibility under trying conditions was open to doubt, and he might fare badly if left behind. On the positive side, he had behaved well during the journey from Patience Camp, and his simple strength was in his favour. By contrast, Timothy McCarthy had never caused anyone a moment's trouble, and he was universally liked. Shackleton picked him for no more complicated reasons than that he was an experienced seaman and that he was built like a bull. As soon as Shackleton made the decision official, McNeish and Marston went to work removing the planks that had been added to the docker in order to fashion a sort of decking over the Caird. The blizzard made working conditions miserable. The rest of the men were busy trying to create some degree of comfort. A new shelter was made for the galley out of packing cases, rocks, and some pieces of canvas. Because of the physical conditions of Blackborough and Rickinson, who was still weak from his heart attack, Shackleton granted permission for the docker to be upended to form a shelter for the members of No. 5 tent. The men did what they could to make this shelter weatherproof by packing snow and mud along one side and draping blankets, coats, and odd bits of canvas from the other. But nothing could be done to dry the ground beneath the boat, which was a stinking mess of melted snow in which penguin guano had dissolved. The discomfort was so intense that even sleeping was almost impossible. The blizzard had continued for 3 days and nights. The winds, which Hussey estimated reached 120 miles per hour, had driven the dust-like snow into everything, even to the very foot of their sleeping bags, which had never even begun to dry out from the boat journey. The strength of the wind made it perilous at times even to venture outside. Occasionally, small blocks of ice were hurled through the air. Once, a 10-gallon cooking pot was whisked from outside the galley and carried almost out of sight before it was dropped into the sea. The forecastle hands lost their hoosh pot when it was put down on a rock for a moment. It simply disappeared. Another time, McLeod spread out his Burberry parka to dry with two stones as large as his head on top of it. When he turned his back for a moment, the wind blew the rocks off, then snatched the parka away. Some men had their mittens blown off. Though a canvas covering was placed over the pile of stores and anchored down by a circle of large rocks, the wind seemed to reach underneath and snitch away small articles. In spite of these miserable conditions, the work of preparing the Caird for her journey went on the following day. McNeish, Marston, and McLeod attached the runners of a dismantled sledge across the upper sides of the boat to form a framework for decking her over. Pieces of plywood from the cases of stores were nailed over these, and a canvas covering of sorts was begun. The mainmast was removed from the docker and lashed inside the Caird's keel, in the hope that she would not break in two when she encountered bad weather. Periodically, Worsley climbed to a ledge of rock about 150 feet high near the Penguin Rookery to observe the ice formation. A narrow belt of broken floes lay offshore, but it did not look too thick to get through. However, Worsley's primary concern was the continuing thick weather which prevented him from obtaining a sight with which to check his only remaining chronometer. Without a sight, they would have to rely on the hope that the chronometer was accurate. Greenstreet's frostbitten hands had recovered somewhat, and he and Bakewell were given the job of providing the Caird with ballast. Together they sewed shale into canvas sacks, about 100 pounds to each sack. The canvas was frozen, and they had to thaw it out a foot at a time by holding it close to the blubber stove. The heat and the rough stones caused the frostbite blisters in Greenstreet's hands to break and then bleed. There were other significant preparations for the journey. Hurley buttonholed Shackleton, who signed the following letter in Hurley's diary.
21st of April, 1916. To whom this may concern, viz. My executors, assigns, etc. Under is my signature to the following instructions. In the event of my not surviving the boat journey to South Georgia, I here instruct Frank Hurley to take complete charge and responsibility for exploitation of all films and photographic reproductions of all films and negatives taken on this expedition, the aforesaid films and negatives to become the property of Frank Hurley after due exploitation, in which the monies to be paid to my executors will be according to the contract made at the start of the expedition. The exploitation expires after a lapse of 18 months from the date of the first public display. I bequeath the big binoculars to Frank Hurley. E. H. Shackleton. Witness, John Vincent. The next day, the blizzard rose to new heights. Several men were cut on the face by bits of flying ice and rock. All work except the simplest cooking was out of the question, and the men stayed in their sleeping bags all day. Wilde predicted that if conditions didn't improve shortly, some of the weaker men would not survive, and Shackleton met secretly with Macklin to ask how long he thought the men who were remaining behind could hold out under such conditions. Macklin said he thought about a month. Fortunately, the wind eased considerably during the night, though a heavy snowfall continued. The temperature dropped sharply. In the morning, McNeish got busy once more with the cairn. All that remained was to finish the canvas decking. Alf Cheatham and Timothy McCarthy were put to sewing the bits of canvas together, but in the bitter cold it was so stiff that they had to pull the needle through it with a pair of pliers at every stitch. At the same time, the welfare of the men who would be left behind was under consideration. For a while they thought of building a hut of stones, but all the available rocks had been worn by the action of the sea until they were very nearly round. Since there was nothing to use for cement, this plan had to be abandoned. Instead, a party of men with picks and shovels began to dig a cave in the face of the glacier at the head of the spit, but the ice proved to be almost rock-hard, and it was slow work. Shackleton spent the day supervising the various activities. He saw that the cairn was very nearly finished, and announced that she would sail as soon as the weather permitted. As evening came on, and the weather looked more promising, Shackleton ordered Ord Lees and Vincent to melt ice to fill the two water casks to be carried aboard the cairn. They made every effort to find freshwater ice from the glacier, but all of it had been tainted slightly by saltwater spray that had frozen against the face of the glacier. When it was ready, Ord Lees took a sample of the melted water to Shackleton, who tasted it. He noted the trace of salt, but he said it would do all right. Shackleton spent almost the whole night talking with Wilde about 100 different subjects, ranging from what should be done in the event that a rescue party failed to arrive within a reasonable length of time, to the distribution of tobacco. When there was nothing more to discuss, Shackleton wrote a letter in his log, which he left with Wilde. April the 23rd, 1916, Elephant Island. Dear Sir, in the event of my not surviving the boat journey to South Georgia, you will do your best for the rescue of the party. You are in full command from the time the boat leaves this island, and all hands are under your orders. On your return to England, you are to communicate with the committee. I wish you, Lees, and Hurley to write the book. You watch my interests. In another letter, you will find the terms as agreed for lecturing. You to do England, Great Britain, and Continent, Hurley, the USA. I have every confidence in you, and always have had. May God prosper your work and your life. You can convey my love to my people, and say I tried my best. Yours sincerely, E. H. Shackleton. Frank Wilde. Chapter 3. Throughout the night, the successive watchmen kept a close watch for a break in the weather.